So I've already really begun the session because I wanted to at least take a few minutes to do a little bit of brainstorming. And that's what the folks that have just arrived, that's what we're involved in doing right now, is both giving any images or impressions that kind of come to mind when you think about Mexico, and or any specific questions that you have that you hope that I might answer at the end of this hour or so together. Yes?
What's your source or your view of the whole thing? Where does it come from?
Gotcha.
Because I realized some other time that I'm very definitely affected by wherever my view originally came from.
Of course, absolutely. I'll get to that in a second. Okay. Well, actually, I'll do that now since it is 6 o'clock. I am Bradley Levinson, and I teach at Indiana University. The main reason I'm here is because I'm the spouse of Rebecca Wee, and she is doing poetry workshops. But I got in touch with Sharon and said I'd be happy to do a session on Mexico, particularly in light of the recent elections, which unfortunately haven't gotten as much coverage in our news since our daily news cycle is so consumed by our own president and his goings on, as it were. We didn't really hear a whole lot about Mexico. Mexico really had a pretty historic election, a very significant election, a very strong swing to the left, a lot of unknowns about the person who is, how he's going to govern, although there's a lot that we know about Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who is the winner of the latest presidential election. And I thought it might be a timely moment to present a session. Now, my own training is as a cultural anthropologist. I actually teach in the School of Education at Indiana University, so my work focuses a lot on the education system, education reform. I've done a lot of work on youth and secondary schooling in particular in Mexico. So this isn't totally in my wheelhouse, so to speak, but I've been going to Mexico in one way or another since 1985. I've lived a total, if you sort of accumulate all the different stays of between a few weeks to a year, I've lived in Mexico for about 5 years of my life, speak Spanish fluently, raised my two daughters, one of whom is here speaking Spanish. And so, you know, I tend to look at things kind of on the ground. I spent my research as ethnographic. I spent a lot of time hanging out with people. But it's also very much broadly informed by the history of Mexico. You can't study education in Mexico without studying history, because schooling in Mexico is very much connected to the rise of the modern nation state and the modern government in Mexico. And so you can't look at education without looking at politics, because education, you know, of course we know that education is always political. Schools are always political in one way or another. But in Mexico, it's kind of even more apparent because the federal government controls government, like is the case in most of the countries in the world. The U.S. is rather the exception than the rule in the way that we have this strongly localized, decentralized. If anything, in our case, in the U.S., the trend has been towards kind of more power concentrated at the federal level, but historically it was at the center. In Mexico, like in so many other places in the world, there's a very strong central federal ministry of education. In Mexico's case, it's the largest bureaucracy. The largest single unit of government is the education ministry, which is called the Secretaría de Educación Pública, the Secretariat of Public Education. The Teachers Workers Union is the very largest union in Latin America, the Sindicato Nacional. Do we have any Spanish speakers here by any chance? No? Okay. Yeah. Well, my daughter raises her hand. Okay. So the National Teachers Union is the largest union in Latin America. So there's a lot of politics, and so I thought that people would be more interested in hearing about politics. My own particular stance, you know, in U.S. politics, I kind of come from a left progressive point of view, and over the years in Mexico, certainly intellectuals in Mexico, and the intellectual milieu is much more kind of left-leaning than right-leaning, and it's been my sort of privilege in many ways to be witnessed since 1985 to a process of democratization in Mexico. And that's a lot of what we're going to talk about today. I'm going to try not to take more than 20 or 25 minutes and really leave a lot of time at the end for questions, because not only do I know a lot about the political system, but if you have any other questions, I know a lot about, you know, civilization and history and so on and so forth, right? So I definitely come at things, if you're asking about my positionality, no?
No.
Go ahead.
You mentioned the Teachers Union as basically Latino, and I'm going, is it uniform all through Latin America, or is it just in Mexico?
In fact, there's now, even in Mexico, it's become a lot more fragmented in recent years. But I was just talking about the Mexican Teachers Union, which, as I'll explain in a moment, was for many years, and in some ways still is, kind of formally tied to the state, where Mexico has, I'm going to use this term, corporatist, which is a term that political scientists use to describe the type of political system that has really governed in Mexico, which even in many ways is still in place after some important democratic transitions. So when I talk about democratization, a lot of it is challenging what was an authoritarian, corporatist regime, so to speak. And that included taking huge sectors of the population, workers, peasants, teachers, and literally kind of tying them into the state, making them formally part of the structure of the state. So that it was kind of like, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. And that's why nominally Mexico has had democratic elections, entre comillas, as we say in Spanish. But every teacher knows that they gotta vote for the ruling party, or at least that was the case up until the year 2000 or so, and that's what we'll talk about. So we already started brainstorming some images, questions, impressions that I hope that we'll be able to touch on. If I don't cover this in my presentation, we'll certainly cycle back to this at the end. We got sort of some positive images and impressions up here, but then some that are perhaps a little bit more on the negative side. I'm going to do a little bit of trivia quiz here also to begin with, which will tie in, which will be informative about the talk. One is, does anyone know Mexico is actually kind of the short nickname for the country of Mexico? Does anyone have any idea what the full name of Mexico is?
The United States of Mexico.
Bingo, yeah. It is the Republic of the United States of Mexico.
Or North America.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why I like the fact that Jeff, is Jeff here? Jeff, yeah, there you are.
This Jeff?
I really like Jeff, the fact that Jeff, in his presentation yesterday, used the term U.S. American when describing America, which we don't hear very often, right? We always hear, and that's a sensitivity to the fact that people south of the border often consider themselves Americans as well. And so, yes, the full title of Mexico is La República Federal de los Estados Unidos Mexicanos, the Federal Republic of... So they have a federal system which is virtually identical to ours in many ways. So that's kind of the punchline. The structure of government is similar. 32 states, was 31 with a federal district like our DC, but one of the interesting things that happened fairly recently, actually just a couple of years ago, is they formally changed what had been called the federal district for many years, el Distrito Federal. And if you were from the Distrito Federal, federal district, you were called, you would say you were from DF, which is how you say DF in Spanish, and you were defeño, and that was kind of the slang term. Now people don't know what to do because the federal district doesn't exist anymore. They took the federal district, which also has an interesting role in the democratization of Mexico, because up until 1992, the, quote, governor of Mexico City, the federal district, wasn't actually the governor. He was called the regent, and he was appointed by the president. So if you can imagine the mayor of D.C. being appointed by the president of the United States, that's the system that they placed. They finally democratized that and made the mayor of the federal district a popularly electable position in 1992, I think. And then more recently, they made it into a state. And by the way, a Jewish woman just won the election for the governorship of Claudia Sheinbaum, is now the governor of the largest state in Mexico, which is called Mexico City. And it's really complicated because there's actually a state in Mexico, which is Mexico. So there's the state of Mexico, where if you're from the state of Mexico, you're called a Mexiquense. And if you're from Mexico more generally, you're called a Mexicano, right? So they even changed kind of the ending if you want to sort of identify where you're from. And the state of Mexico surrounds on three sides, not on four sides, the what used to be the federal district, what is now the actual 32nd state of Mexico. So they have a federal system, supposed to be, in theory, separate. They also have a bicameral legislature, they call it, but it's the way that they're elected is very similar. I won't go into the details of sort of how many, you know, representatives for each state, but there's essentially like a Senate and a House of Reps. The Cámara de Diputados has a lot more people. It's much more multi-party. There are a lot of smaller parties that are able to be represented, especially in the Cámara de Diputados, which is like our House of Reps. There is an independent judiciary, in theory, the Supreme Court, and then, of course, executive branch. But the reality in Mexico, for a variety of reasons, has been that and also, of course, a balance of powers between states and even municipalities. In the Mexican Constitution, municipalities, which more or less map onto our counties here in the U.S., but they actually call them municipios, municipalities, they are supposed to have a lot of power. And yet, in reality, there's this one of the perennial problems that Mexicans themselves point to is this disjuncture between kind of what the law says and what actually happens. As one of my dear Mexican friends said, in Mexico, the law is a mere suggestion. It's una mera sugerencia, which is, and that expresses kind of a certain rueful self-recognition that many Mexicans have about themselves and their society, and a kind of determination to change that. And there has been a really vibrant movement to democratize society in lots of different ways, starting with breaking down this single-party system that I'll explain a little bit more here. Okay, so they have a federal system, which in theory they have a very liberal constitution, the first of which went back to 1857. What year was Mexico founded? When did Mexico become independent?
Before 1810.
1810.
I said it was before 36,
because
that's when
Texas
broke off.
Yeah, exactly, right. So Mexico, like many other parts of Latin America, Central America achieved its independence, certainly Central America, which was kind of part of the Spanish colonial unit of New Mexico, New Spain, I should say, that gained its independence. They count 1810, but it was actually a protracted struggle for about 10 years until 1821. And then ironically, some say, coincidentally, some say not, the first main constitution of Mexico, they lived without a constitution basically until 1857. And then Benito Juarez, who is kind of like the Abraham Lincoln of Mexico, one of the great and most revered presidents, presided over the creation of the 1857 constitution. But in the revolution, which breaks out in 1910, exactly 100 years, the 100 year anniversary of independence, and goes more or less, 10 or 11 years, and doesn't, hostilities don't cease until about 1921. So there's this odd kind of parallel between the struggle for independence and then the revolution, which is a struggle against the dictatorship of Porfirio Diaz, who installed himself in power and continued there for almost 30 years. And the revolution was about large landowners not allowing small peasants to work their land. It was about social justice. So the existing constitution of Mexico actually goes back to 1917. It was kind of hammered out when hostilities were still ongoing. And it represented an interesting kind of compromise between what's thought of as the southern faction, which probably more of you are familiar with. Emiliano Zapata is a key figure. He's a peasant, and he's fighting primarily for land and for the rights of peasants to work their land. He's kind of the more radical, if you will. Pancho Villa is a very probably well-known figure to many of you who comes from the north. So the revolution in Mexico in 1910 to 1920 kind of had a northern faction and a southern faction, and they were comprised of different elements of different interests that didn't have all exactly the same vision. So they kind of hammered out in the constitution. The constitution is considered, certainly at the time, was by far the most progressive constitution. Why? Because it actually has an article in it guaranteeing labor rights. It has the third article of the Mexican Constitution says the state will be responsible for providing education to all of its people free of charge. That is a kind of a constitutional promise which still to this day is yet to be completely fulfilled, although by now there is nearly universal enrollment in Mexican education and so forth. So, does anyone know when Mexican Independence Day is?
Cinco
de Mayo. No, that's a very common misconception that 5th of May is. Does anyone know what Cinco de Mayo does celebrate?
The defeat of Napoleon's army.
Good. Yeah, this gentleman knows quite a bit. Yeah, it marks the so-called Battle of Puebla, which was a battle in which outnumbered Mexican forces beat the French invasionary force of Maximilian of Habsburg, there was a collusion between Mexican conservatives and to overthrow Benito Juarez. And although they won that battle, they lost the war, and they were actually under a French emperor for a couple of years until the forces regrouped and took power back in Mexico. So it's a moment of national pride, of kind of military pride, but it's really just a civic holiday. So anyone know what Independence Day is? It's September 15th. September 15th / 16th. It's getting interesting. They usually celebrate both days because the way it gets celebrated is on the 15th, supposedly the act that marks the independence movement is the shout of Father Dolores Hidalgo. He was a radical priest who was a rabble-rouser. Of course, the Spanish Crown saw him as a big rabble-rouser. And he was up in Guanajuato, which is a few hours now by car north of Mexico City. And he, around midnight, they've been planning and organizing. He gives the shout, he gives the word that says that it's time to start the revolution, to move into action. There have been military plans. So now, on September 15th, that night in Mexico, they reenact what they call El Grito de Hidalgo, Hidalgo's shout. We don't know whether really he shouted or what he shouted, but the president comes out on the balcony of the presidential palace, mayors come out on their balconies, governors come out on their balconies, they're in every civic plaza in Mexico, they reenact they ring a bell and they do a series of Viva Mexicos, Long Live Mexico, where the person, the governor or president says Viva Mexico and the crowd responds, Viva Mexico. And if you're in a small regional town like I was, the first time I experienced this, and everybody was standing like this, you know, kind of in this big crowd, and I was like about a 75-year-old woman standing next to me, and after the Viva Mexico, a little beknown to me, she pulls up a 45 Colt revolver, and boom, 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 shoot. I don't know, I don't think they allow them to do that in Mexico City, but in the small, I was working in a regional city, and people were shooting guns off all around the balconies, second floor balconies of hotels, so that's part of the tradition as well. Any idea of what the population of Mexico is? Like, and where it is kind of in the world in terms of size of both population and like economy? No? So okay, we have about 120 million people, our best guess. Since we haven't had a census, you know, since 2010, and that puts it in about 10th place in terms of countries and world population, and actually its economy is about that size as well. So if you were to look at a list of most populous countries, of course we know China, India, U.S., Russia. Fourth place is Indonesia. A lot of people don't realize how populous Indonesia is. And Japan, you have a few countries, and you get pretty quickly. Brazil, of course, is the largest country in Latin America. Mexico is the second largest country in Latin America by population. So we're talking about a pretty sizable country. And then geographically, before I want to just sort of shift into the more political narrative here, you know, Mexico is a place, I had hoped to be able to project a map here. It's a place of enormous contrasts, not unlike the United States, you know, which is got significant territory with mountains, and you know, Mexico has a little bit of everything, right? It goes from the northern desert and some very high mountains to the central, what's called the central volcanic belt of Mexico. So kind of central Mexico, Mexico City, as you know, has got a couple of volcanoes, and there's a whole belt of still active volcanoes across that goes from the Pacific coast over to the Gulf Coast. In Mexico, and then you get when you get a little bit south below Mexico City, you start getting into subtropical and eventually tropical jungle. So you go all the way to the Yucatan Peninsula, Cancun, and the Mayan ruins and so forth, and you're talking about you know, very hot and humid jungle for most of the year. So you've got tremendous mountain ranges. One of my favorite trivia questions is always, what is the largest peak? What is the largest mountain peak between Mount Denali in Alaska and the Andean Mountains in South America? So the Andean Mountains get up above 20,000 feet. Of course, we know that Mount McKinley or Denali, if you prefer, is also above 20,000 feet. In the continental US, we know we don't get above, what is it, 14,400, Mount Whitney, Mount Rainier, both about the same height. Mexico has 16, 17 plus volcanoes, and Pico de Orizaba, the peak of Orizaba, is actually the largest, the tallest mountain between Alaska and South America. Just a little trivia piece there. Okay, so let me kind of continue to sort of walk you through for 10 or 15 more minutes, then we'll open up for questions, just about kind of how we got to the current moment in Mexican politics, what has been the history moving forward from the revolution. So the revolution basically ends in 1920. I already talked about sort of the progressive elements of it. Was meant to put in place an extensive agrarian reform, which was going to include breaking up a lot of these large estates that are called latifundios and giving them over to peasants to work, allowing them to have to return to a communal regime, as it were, of working the land, so that it wasn't, you know, each person having their own private piece of land, but the community would own it kind of corporatively or collectively, and they would have to make decisions together. That's called the ejido. If anyone's ever heard the term ejido, that's an important kind of, it's a term that comes from the Nahuatl language. I also want to mention, by the way, I was talking about the geographic diversity of Mexico, the cultural diversity. As you may or may not know, roughly 60 indigenous languages still spoken in Mexico. But perhaps, you know, comparing the situation there with the U.S., for instance, much higher percentage of the population, right? Here we know our Native American groups. First of all, they had not achieved Native Americans in the U.S., at least at the time of conquest, did not live in settlements of more than maybe a few thousand. They tended to be more dispersed, engaged in small-scale agriculture, hunting and gathering. You probably know that in Mexico there were large-scale civilizations, those that we commonly call the Aztecs, which is a bit of a misnomer because the Aztecs is actually the name of what was called the Triple Alliance between the Mexica peoples and a couple of other groups. Together they called themselves the Aztecs, but they had only been in existence for about, that alliance had only been in existence for about 10 years when Hernan Cortes arrived in 1521 to try to attempt the conquest of Mexico. So the Mexica, which is where the name Mexico comes from, is the particular tribe that migrated from the northern arid areas and founded its and sort of decided to take up residence in the capital, what they call Tenochtitlan, which is where Mexico City is today. They founded there, and they were a very aggressive society, a conquering society, and they expanded and they subjugated a number of peoples, and they used a lot of their wealth to build majestic temples. And when the Spaniards arrived, Diaz del Castillo and other explorers that were accompanying Hernan Cortes, who were writing reports back to Spain, talked about just how magnificent the cities were. It's believed to be the largest city in the world at the time. They were saying, you wouldn't believe this, this city is bigger than London or Madrid or Paris or any of the largest European cities. And in fact, you know, very orderly. They were impressed with the construction of streets and so forth. So part of the story here is that, you know, the percentage of current day Mexicans who still identify themselves as indigenous is somewhere between 10 to 15%. It's very difficult, of course, because some people self-identify. There's a question about whether speaking an actual language is the definition of being indigenous, or having a kind of affiliation even if you no longer speak the language. And the census, like happens here in the U.S., the census often changes in terms of how it defines indigenous. And so it's hard to come up with a strict figure. But there are still groups of people with up to a million plus speakers. Nahuatl, which is kind of derived from the ancient the language that the Aztecs and Mexica speak, is still spoken by over a million people. Yucatec Maya, the Mayan language has many different dialects and varieties, but Yucatec Maya, which is spoken in the Yucatecan Peninsula, is still spoken by nearly a million people, and so on. There are a number of languages that have various tens of or hundreds of thousands of speakers, and so they're a significant part of Mexican society and politics, and part of the story of democratization in Mexico has also been, how are we going to meaningfully integrate indigenous cultural concerns into public life and political life, because as you might imagine, they are heavily discriminated against. They are often kind of exalted historically, and their contribution to the greatness of Mexican society is often noted, and they have a great museum of anthropology and so forth in Mexico City. But in the present day, they're still very much discriminated against, right? To be an Indian, in many ways, to be seen as being backwards, right? To be not fully modern in some sense. And so that's part of the challenge in Mexico, is realizing the fullness of indigenous rights in Mexico. So I talked about this notion of a corporate estate. So I really want to make sure that I clarify this point. What emerges out of the revolution throughout the 1920s, and by 1930 or so, is essentially the creation of a single party. And what happens is you have then between 1930 and the year 2000, 70 years of uninterrupted rule of a single party. The party known as El PRI, some of you, if you've ever heard of it, the PRI, which literally stands for the Partido de la Revolución Institucional, which means, it's an interesting kind of contradictory term. It means the institutionalized party of the revolution. So it kind of says it all in a way, doesn't it? It's like, okay, we're gonna call ourselves revolutionary, but we're gonna kind of set this thing in stone a little bit, right? So you have, because after the formal cessation of hostilities, you still have a lot of conflict in Mexico. You have a lot of interest groups vying for power. You have still a lot of conflict between church and state, because the government that emerges in the revolutionary from the revolution is actually a very strongly anti-clerical state. Believes that because the prior dictatorship of Porfirio Diaz had very much relied on the church to kind of keep people down, they thought the church was. The Catholic Church was basically complicit with injustice and keeping people in misery and sustaining. And so the part of the Constitution, that Article 3 and other articles, makes very clear a separation of church and state. The church cannot be involved in public education. Even there are church-run schools, but they're very heavily regulated and inspected by the state, and they have to follow the same calendar and lots of other things. And what happened throughout by the late 20s is you got also an act of what was called the Christian Wars, where certain regions of Mexico were still rebelling against the central government, and often being fomented by the church in some way, by the Catholic Church in that activity. So there was a lot of need, felt need to kind of unify the country, and the sort of price that was paid, you might say, was a certain lack of democracy, because the government essentially creates this single party, the PRI, which has this, what political scientists call the corporatist structure, where formally incorporated into it is the National Campesino Union, for instance. And then there's the National Workers Union, because by the 1930s, the oil industry is really ramping up in Mexico, and you get the development of the national oil company, Pemex, as a significant source of wealth. Some of you may know about the expropriation of the oil industry in 1938 is a tremendously important part of Mexican history. The president, Lázaro Cárdenas, is one of the most beloved figures in Mexican history because he had the nerve to stand up to the foreign oil companies, and he actually took up a collection. There's these wonderful images and stories of Mexicans donating their jewelry and other things to try to come up with a fair enough amount to pay. Because they didn't just steal the oil installations outright. They wanted to pay the largely British and American companies fair price, but they thought that oil needed to be nationalized to be their own. And so part of that process involved creating this corporate structure where there would be kind of loyalty built into the system, and there would be workers, campesino workers, urban manufacturing workers. There was also an organization corresponding to kind of business, small business and medium-sized business owners. And they were all sort of formally in cahoots, as it were, or allied with the state and felt obligated to vote for the PRI. So what you have from basically 1930 till 1980s, for the 50 years, is these simulated elections where the pre-candidates win, almost 100% of the votes. or some rare cases there were opposition candidates that emerged, and there were one of the current parties of the right in Mexico, the Partido de Acción Nacional, the PAN, which literally means bread in Spanish, they actually have a long history. They go back, they have been fighting against the PRI for many years, and had even managed to win a few municipalities, mayoralties, but throughout that period, all governorships in Mexico were pre-governors, and they really had a lockdown on the system. A lot of corruption, not a very free press, a lot of political repression for those who wanted to kind of genuinely try to open up the system to have a much more viable kind of multi-party system. And then you get really, there's some really crucial events that happen in the 60s and 70s. You have the 1968 massacre that many of you may have heard of, right before the Olympics occurred, that were being held in Mexico City. Hundreds of students were massacred in the Plaza de Tlatelolco because they were protesting inequality and poverty, and shockingly, the repressive president of Mexico at the time, like in that tradition, sent elite Mexican units of the army to fire at will against these kids that were. So that's that moment is a defining moment for many people in politics. Throughout the late 60s and early 70s, there's a lot of guerrilla movements occurring in Mexico. There's a lot of outright repression. And then there's an attempt by the presidency of the 1970s to kind of co-opt some of that and bring them into the fray. By the late 1970s, early 80s, you actually get some significant electoral reforms where there's more resources being given to opposition parties. And to kind of speed this up even more quickly, basically you begin by the 1980s, you get the first governorships actually conceded to the PAN party, especially in Baja California and northern Mexico. So you break up that monopoly of the PRI, of the ruling party in governorships. You have 1988 was a significant year in which it's widely believed, almost universally believed, that Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, the son of that previous president I mentioned, who did the expropriation of the petroleum industry, that he won the presidency in 1988. But the system, as an opposition candidate to the PRI, but the PRI was not ready to concede power, and so they said that there had been a problem in the system, the voting system, it went down, and lo and behold, the PRI candidate ended up winning. There was a huge outcry in Mexican society. Ever since then, by the way, as this year, there's always been large numbers of foreign electoral observers that go to Mexico to really observe the process leading up to voting day and on voting day to assure that there's more transparency, because so many people believe that the presidency was just kind of really taken away outright from Cárdenas. So the PRI wasn't really ready to give up power in 1988, and pretty much continued until 2000. 2000 is a really important year, because that's when the PRI formally loses the presidency. The PAN, Vicente Fox, wins the presidency in 2000, and the PAN controls the executive then for 12 years. In Mexico, the presidency is 6 years. It's called the sexenio, and there's no re-election. Right? That's one of the constitutional principles from 1917. That was partly because what Porfirio Diaz, that dictatorship, he ran elections, but he would just constantly get re-elected. Right? So part of the principle is no re-election. So you have two different PAN presidents between 2000 and 2012, but things do not really improve much in Mexico over that period. In fact, in many ways, they worsen. The rise of violence, especially related to the growth of the narcotics industry and the carteles, as they're known, the groups that jockey for position, for control of the drug trade. By 2006, when Felipe Calderón is elected as the second PAN president, he devises a strategy where he sends the army out into the streets and basically militarizes the situation, but actually makes it much worse, because he creates even more infighting between the narco carteles and the homicide rate. He was supposed to be clamping down on it, but in fact the homicide rate went up a great deal, and As someone mentioned, in terms of talking about political corruption and violence, there's a lot of collusion occurring. Always did, goes way back, but even the PAN arrived promising more transparency, a big change, as you would imagine, from the way that the PRI had been doing things. But what many Mexicans saw happening was kind of a lot of more of the same, and in fact, even a worsening in many ways of the kind of corruption that they had always seen. Also, a lot of collusion, where you end up finding out that elements of the police and the army are in fact basically collaborating with the cartels and essentially colluding to control territory and extracting money from people, you know, actually extorting people for money, even regular businesses coming in saying, look, you got to pay me a big tax just for you to operate here, with no authority whatsoever, no government authority, just because I've got guns and I'm going to kill you and your family if you don't do what I say to do, or I'm going to shut your business down. And the authorities, the police and the legal system, are either in cahoots with that or are too scared themselves to do anything about it. And that's a big part of frustration in Mexican society that is building throughout this time, is the growth of the sort of narco power and the apparent collusion of the state. Now, what's also happening during this time is a lot of ongoing privatization. The Mexican government, coming out of the revolution, like I said, they nationalized the oil industry. They also controlled, up until the 1980s and early 1990s, they controlled very important segments of the economy. The telephone company was Telmex, was a national telephone company. The electrical system, the trains, very significant sectors of the economy were government-owned enterprises. There's this movement, some people call it the neoliberal trend in political economy to really move away from state involvement in enterprises and to privatize. And Pemex is actually the one remaining, and that's a very controversial point in Mexico, because a lot of people have wanted to. Pemex has already been sort of semi-privatized. Up to 49% of Pemex consists of foreign investors, but the Mexican government maintains majority ownership. And yet, if López Obrador had not won, López Obrador is strongly against that. He actually would like to. He represents the kind of populist. A kind of populist nationalism, the winner of this last election that just occurred a couple of weeks ago. If he'd had his druthers, he'll actually return it to being fully, partly because it's very symbolic that the state controls, and that was kind of the last redoubt of state control of the economy. But what you have going from 2000 to 2012, you actually have pretty moderate, decent economic growth. You don't have a calamitous economic situation. Necessarily, but of course it's very uneven growth, and you have the increase in rates of inequality in Mexico. So you, as some of you may know, some of the world's richest people are in fact from Mexico. Carlos Slim González is the one who's number three or number four, right behind Bill Gates, and some of the few wealthiest. He's way up there among the wealthiest on the planet. That's kind of representative in some ways of the fact that about 36 Mexican families control something like 40 or 50% of Mexican, and that's extremely complicated, concentrated. And I don't have the exact figure at hand, but those who study very closely income distribution rates have shown very clearly that they're already pretty. Mexico was already one of the most unequal, along with Brazil, countries in the world, and certainly in Latin America. And over the last 10 or 12 years, if anything, it's been getting worse. So you get decent performance in the macroeconomy, but at the microeconomic level, in terms of distribution, it's still very clearly favoring owners of capital and so forth.
Yeah, a friend of mine who was studying that kind of statistics around that was saying about 60% of the Mexican population live at or below the poverty line.
Exactly. And you remember, governments define poverty, right? So the poverty line in Mexico is much lower in terms of actual income and purchasing power and so forth than it is even in the United States, right? So, you know, that's it's pretty shocking. Now, they also use the term extreme poverty. There's only about 15% or 18% of Mexicans are living in extreme poverty, but like you said, the majority of Mexicans are kind of officially below the poverty line. So let me just kind of close up and then open up for questions, just kind of to describe what happens between 2012 and 2018. You actually, in 2012, you get the return of the PRI to the presidency, okay? So for the last 6 years, the PRI returned, it promised, it said it had been reformed. It used to be that the PRI, the way the PRI selected presidents was they would simply, it was called, if you know the word for finger in Mexico, in Spanish, it's dedo, right? And they have this wonderful term in Mexican Spanish, el dedazo, which is hard to translate. It means the finger point. But it indicates the way the pre-presidents always handpicked their successors, right? And there would be a moment in which there'd be what they call the destape, the uncovering of the dedazo, because it was really just the president pointing at who was going to. So even there was not even like a democratic process within the party about who would become the next president. It was always about the president and his small group of confidants would sort of decide who's the best person to kind of really carry on the torch from here. So the PRI comes back in 2012, says we're now a very robustly democratic, you know, party. We're a different party. They kind of position themselves as the centrist party, whereas the PAN, which has been holding the presidency from 2012, and many governorships as well, PAN was doing very well, never got a majority in the legislature, but had a healthy parliamentary minority. Now on the left, there was a party of what was called the Party of the Democratic Revolution, el Partido de la Revolución Democrática. So you had basically, throughout the early 2000s, three parties. You were sort of PRI kind of comes to position itself as the center, PAN on the right, PRD on the left. But from 2012-2018, the PRI is in power and things continue to get worse in many ways. Especially the question of security and the question of corruption, which have been driving a lot of the movements for democratization in Mexico, continue to get worse. There were a couple of notorious cases. Some of you may have heard about the disappearance and presumed murder of 43 students who were actually studying to be teachers. It was what's called a rural normal school, which is an institution that still exists, goes way back to the time of the revolution, these rural-based, where children of peasants could go and subsidized by the state could become teachers. Well, without going into a lot of details, this one particular normal school had always traditionally been a kind of seedbed of revolutionary, anti-authoritarian politics, and someone did not, wanted to really stick it to them and stick it to them good, and they basically disappeared. They murdered outright in the streets of Iguala, the state of Guerrero. They murdered a number of them, and then they sort of hijacked the buses that they were on and took them away, and there's never been any definitive conclusion to that case. They supposedly were burned, incinerated, but there's been no definitive forensic evidence that's been discovered saying that this is where they are. And so you've got that case amongst many others, similar kinds of massacres, disappearances, very high-profile case of Florence Cassez, this French resident who's in Mexico, decides to kind of live in Mexico, has a Mexican boyfriend. She gets caught up in this kidnapping case where she gets accused of, because her boyfriend was very tangentially involved in kidnapping, she actually served almost stayed 7 or 8 years in a Mexican prison with absolutely no evidence whatsoever that she was involved. And I just finished reading a book that kind of relates that case in great detail, showing the incredible the injustice of the Mexican legal system, where they're able to torture and obtain tortured confessions from torture, and there's ties with the media, where the media, Mexico also right now is the most dangerous place to be, one of the most dangerous places to be a journalist. You mentioned the political assassination of political candidates, a lot of assassinations of of journalists who are covering human rights abuses and things of that sort. So people are getting really fed up with this and coming out into the street. So probably the single most important issue for Mexicans leading up to this most recent election really is, more than anything, more than the economy, is security and transparency, right? And not allowing politicians to act with impunity. This term impunity, impunidad, and you hear this a lot in Mexican society, that's what Mexicans are fed up with, that you can have politicians that can get away with pretty naked corruption that is even proven by the media, and yet prosecution never occurs because there are all these links between the judge, the legal system, and politics and so forth. And the popularity of AMLO, as he's called, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. A lot of people call him Obrador. There's this tradition in Mexico where, because Mexicans have two last names, right? They keep their mother's last name, the father's name, last name. So, but often in when people refer to people, if someone has a less common last name, like López Obrador, they'll refer to him as Obrador, because everyone knows who you're talking about, right? But if you talk about López, that's one of the most common last names in Mexico. So a lot of people call him Obrador, which literally means worker, or more affectionately, his followers call him AMLO, which is the way you pronounce A-M-L-O, he's got two first names and two last names. And he's been in politics for many years. To kind of bring a close to this, he was the governor, he was involved in the PRI, and then he eventually broke away from the PRI. He sort of said, this is way too corrupt that I want to be involved with this, but he actually served as a PRI governor of the state of Tabasco, which is from the southeast, getting over towards the Yucatan Peninsula. He actually was elected as the mayor of Mexico City in the mid-90s, and had very high approval ratings serving as mayor of Mexico City. And then he's run this third consecutive presidential election, had generated a lot of interest. He first ran on the PRD ticket. He was part of the Party of the Democratic Revolution, which was the left party. But that party, starting a number of years ago, became widely discredited. One of the things that's been happening in Mexico in recent years is a lot of disgust with party politics in general, that parties have themselves come to be seen as corrupt. They actually get a lot of money because of electoral laws in Mexico are very evenly. They don't have anything like we have with free for all, you know, citizens versus united, corporations can do. They don't. They actually, no money can be spent other than what the federal government, and the federal government puts a lot of money in. So it's actually a big chunk of money that the parties get, and there's a lot of corruption in the way the parties actually use those public monies that they get to run campaigns for their various candidates. So AMLO, who was a candidate for PRD, he eventually disavows the PRD, the left party, which is seen as being really corrupt, and he creates this national movement, which he names the National Movement for the Movement for National Renovation. So Morena is the acronym for the Movement for National Renovation. Morena happens to mean in Mexico brown or dark skinned. So if you call someone un moreno, you're kind of referring to someone who's darker skin, who's probably got more indigenous ancestry. And that's also sort of, you know, symbolic, you know, that López Obrador stands as kind of, he has a kind of populist image and discourse, that he's a man of the people. He's a very simple person. He's always eschewed. He lives in a modest middle-class apartment in Mexico City. He doesn't believe in having huge security details. He's pledged, I don't know if they're going to let it happen, but he's pledged at the presidential palace in Mexico. They have the presidential palace, unlike in the U.S. where we have White House where the president lives and also does the work. There's the presidential residence, and then there's the national palace where he goes to work. He says, I don't need no palace. He's going to turn the presidential palace called Los Pinos, the Pines, into a museum and a park. I don't know if they'll let him do that because, you know, when he's not president anymore, the next one might want to have a residence, right? But that was part of him saying, you know, he believes that politicians have always lived too high off the hog. He's a regular person. He wants to devote himself to service. He, by the way, the 2006 election, He lost officially by like 0.3% of the vote to the PAN, the right-wing candidate. A lot of people felt that there was fraud that occurred in that election, that a lot of people were not in the system, and even thinking about how U.S. under the surface is probably influencing things as well through the embassy and so forth, that he actually protested his loss. He never conceded victory in that. And that made him actually a less competitive candidate in 2012, because a lot of people, what he did for many months after the election, so all of his supporters got out on the streets, shut down traffic, and he installed himself as the legitimate president. He called the other one the illegitimate president. And a lot of people sort of, after a while, even some of his supporters got kind of fed up, because you just can't go on like that. You know, life's got to go on. You can't hang up the traffic of the city for that long. So he kind of lost a lot of political capital, and people thought he had too big an ego, that he wasn't willing to accept defeat and so forth. So in 2012, he didn't do quite as well. But then between 2012 and 2018, he started garnering a lot of support, and he won by a landslide. He won in Mexico. You actually don't need a majority to win the presidency. You only need a plurality of votes. And yet he actually achieved 53-54%, which is kind of really unheard of in the modern era, unless it were a pre-candidate. back in the day, winning 90% plus, he won 53% plus of the votes. The next two candidates from the PRI and the PAN won like 23%, 17%. So it's really a landslide. It's kind of an interesting moment where you have someone with a mandate who really has a perspective from the left in terms of really combating injustices, creating an economy where there's greater distribution of income, where businesses pay a higher tax rate, because Mexican businesses pay an extremely low tax rate and take advantage of all kinds of loopholes and so forth. He's promised to get tough on that. But people are also concerned about the fact that he's a little bit too much of a populist. They're worried that he's going to turn in, a lot of people think he's going to turn into an Hugo Chavez. He's going to turn into a more authoritarian leader because he's so full of himself, and he sees himself as so much the kind of repository of the will of the people, that he could, in some ways, ironically, he has, for instance, he's not been terribly open towards NGOs, non-government organizations, smaller NGOs on the left, inviting them to be part of his process. He's kind of like, well, I've got my people, I've got my thing. So there's some concern, even though a lot of people say it's time sort of to give the left a chance to govern Mexico and see if they can do things, especially on this point of corruption, because he himself represents in his figure someone who no one has any significant dirt on him, which is really pretty amazing for someone who's been in politics, who was mayor of Mexico City and so forth. Did a lot of public works projects that were very popular in Mexico City, has never been caught, you know, building a huge house for himself by having redirected funds from public coffers, as one so often finds. And so he has a kind of moral standing and a lot of good political capital right now. It'll be really interesting to see what happens. So I will stop there and take questions about politics or any other aspect of Mexico. Like I said, I'd be happy to take it. Yes, you, sir, and then we'll go up here.
Okay.
Yeah, please.
One of the figures that has stuck with me for a long time, beginning in the 60s, is population and population growth.
Yeah.
In 1960, the population of Latin America was about 200 million, with a growth rate of 3.5% per year. It's now 600 million and growing.
Right.
And that underlies so much of the pressures that are represented here.
Sure.
And when you look at the economy and the cost per person to live, that's forcing humanity worldwide. But I wondered if you want to comment on that as an underlying dynamic of what's happening right now.
Sure. It's tough to, you know, the problem with citing, there's no question that population growth always, you know, increases pressure for, you know, finite number of resources for a growing, you know, number of people. Yet, you know, there are countries with much higher growth rates than Mexico, like Bangladesh is an interesting example. that have actually kind of solved the distribution, not, I shouldn't say solve, but have dealt with and are continuing to deal with the kind of the inequality problem and the problem of absolute poverty. So there's a question about sort of, you know, yes, it would be great to and there are efforts in Mexico to actually, there's different kinds of programs to kind of educational programs to get people to reconsider family size. It is a Catholic country, and so there's that kind of cultural legacy of having large families. Also, as having this deep agricultural history, and we know that agricultural families tend to want to have lots of kids to help out for labor. But I think the economic distribution problem is kind of really what's at heart of it, because in my sense, you know, the rate of population growth in Mexico, if you think about, you know, redistributing and allowing and having public works kinds of projects and sort of social safety nets, you would be able to still grow the economy and still be able to sort of cover the basic needs. The problem is this incredible disparity where you have people like the gentleman said, you know, 60% living below the, and that isn't necessarily, that number has actually, you know, the percentage actually has not changed all that dramatically. That percentage has been, you know, it's been 50%, it's grown a little bit. So population growth is, you know, part of the story there, but part of the story is also kind of the way the resources, the collective wealth of a society kind of continues to get siphoned off in so many ways towards the super wealthy who continue to live in great opulence at the expense. So that's my own sort of political position, you know. And you can think about this at the global scale also. I mean, at some point, we can't live with, you know, unlimited human growth, because we see the impact on the environment, and we see that it does, there is a, you know, a limit.
There's not enough natural resources to serve the population if you're living too high on the log.
Right, right. Although, again, when you look in a society where one family owns 10 different huge mega houses in different parts of the country, different parts of the world, and is consuming a lot of resources just to maintain that conspicuously, you know, that conspicuous lifestyle, then you think redistribution, you think about justice, and that maybe that number of people could be supported by the same resources if the resources were kind of more justly distributed. But that's an important point. I hand it here first, and over here, yeah.
Oh, I wanted to ask, what, in your opinion, were the largest effects of NAFTA on Mexico? And can you remind me again what NAFTA was?
NAFTA is, I remember in graduate school, having NAFTA basically gets signed in 93 or 94, 93. I think, yeah. So that's a big question, and, you know, depending on the politics and economics of someone, you'd get a different answer, you know, because NAFTA creates positive growth. You could look at it from a macroeconomic point of view. You know, NAFTA creates, after an initial, in 94, there's a big crisis, right around the time there's the devaluation of the peso and so forth, but after stability is achieved after 94, you actually have, you know, pretty decent economic growth. So by conventional economic indicators, NAFTA has been good to Mexico, right? Because it's opened up U.S. markets. It's also opened up Mexico to U.S. investment, which has created jobs. But the rub, of course, is always, what kind of jobs? Right? We have to ask our own politicians that. We always hear this in the U.S., right? Going to create more jobs, 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 fine. But what if they are all minimum wage jobs, which in Mexico, the minimum wage is about 10% of what our minimum wage is here. Like, the minimum wage in Mexico is, it depends on region, but it's like $15 a day or $12 a day in some of the poor parts of Mexico. So it's 7-8 times lower than ours. So you get someone a job at you know, minimum wage, sometimes below minimum wage because they're, you know, in the informal economy. There's still people making minimum wage in Mexico still live below the poverty line, unless you have, like, you know, mother, father, grandmother, grandfather, everyone in the household is all contributing, and maybe then they manage to make it out of it. But so you get the creation of the growth and creation of the maquiladoras, the factories, especially in Ciudad Juarez along the border. You get a bump in Mexican agriculture exporting to the U.S., you know, increase in strawberries and so forth. So you get the creation of jobs, but again, it's that distribution issue. So a lot of people would say that, you know, again, how much are real Mexicans? Because the bottom line is the poverty rate itself hasn't really changed significantly after NAFTA. So macroeconomic health, but microeconomic misery, you might say. I saw a question over here.
Comment.
Yeah, sure, please.
To go to the NAFTA thing, from what I had heard is that that NAFTA is really good. Mexico's economy is great, but the majority of the money is staying with a certain population. And so one of the complaints with NAFTA is, or one of the things that the current president, this new president is trying to do, correct me if I'm wrong, is he's trying to redistribute what the jobs are so that more of the money is going in the pocket of the everyday person and the small business owner instead of the corporations. And so by kind of looking at NAFTA, the different trade treaties now differently, the idea being that it's going to be more for the little guy. At least that's what it...
Well, we'll see. Well, one of the really interesting things about AMLO, López Obrador, is that he moderated his discourse significantly in this latest campaign. He was much less of a firebrand, stick-it-to-the-man populist than he had been. And in fact, people surmise the reason he never won was because conservatives and business people, and especially in Mexico, were just scared to hell that he was going to try to re-nationalize, you know, all these industries. And he's actually been very careful to kind of cultivate good relationships with the business class in Mexico. So one of the reasons why he had such an impressive victory was that he actually got a lot of support from business, which had not been true. So there's people further on the left who are kind of worried about that. They're worried that he's going to make too many concessions to big business, and that's going to kind of water down his supposed, commitment to really creating more equitable distribution of resources. And how he does that dance, I think, will be really interesting to see over the next couple of years, how he sort of doesn't alienate, large businesses that do, after all, can withdraw capital, say, heck with this, you know, and wreak havoc on the economy if they're not players. So you're always kind of a little bit between a rock and a hard place at any moment that you're starting out trying to, in this moment in which there is this great concentration of wealth, and you're trying to kind of convince some of those who have a lot of this wealth to invest it in different kinds of ways, to pay higher rates of taxes, but promise them that it's not going to be catastrophic for them. So he's, that they have to pay their fair share, but he's not going to try to take away everything that they work for. Yes, please.
Going back to that question of inequality, so you mentioned earlier a statistic that 36 families or so controlled a gigantic proportion of Mexican economy. And so I was wondering what kind of influence or participation these families had on the Mexican government.
Sure. Well, yeah, that's a big question. There's a lot of interrelationships and intermarriages, as you might imagine, but at least formally, the political system now and the latest elections showed that enough reform has occurred, and because money is not allowed into the system in the way that it is in our system, their hands are tied in some important ways in terms of how they can really directly affect the electoral outcome, right? So they can't just provide, millions or billions of dollars to the candidate they want to, right? That's something that people are really looking out for and prosecuting a lot in Mexico, as they've really taken electoral law reforms much more seriously. So they influence through other ways. They influence a lot through media. That continues to be an issue in Mexico, that the main television stations are owned by some of the wealthiest and have ties to those, either are those families or have ties. And so they easily, the news will have an ideological slant towards, large business capitalism or towards the existing system. That was certainly the case under the PRI, and that continues to be the case. A lot of the newspapers, are also, so the effect is, the way that those families can kind of affect the system is not sort of direct as it is in the U.S. system with the way that we've allowed money to kind of take over our politics, but there's other ways that they influence. But again, this latest election shows that I would suspect that most of them were favoring the PRI or the PAN candidate. So, but you know, they're not that much many people, so they couldn't really control the outcome of the election the way they have been able to in the past. We were supposed to end. I know we got to end certainly by 7:15, but another couple of questions I'd be glad to take. Yeah, as you go and ask, please.
This person's predecessor in 2006 tried to control corruption and violence with the military. I don't understand how this person is going to control corruption and violence. What's the pitch?
That's a really good question. I haven't studied, I can't claim that I've studied in detail kind of what his position is, but what he and many people kind of more on the left have been arguing for is much more community involvement. What's happened is you tend to get the military involved and federal and state police forces that have very little, if any, trust. And there's this huge trust gap in Mexico between law enforcement and everyday citizen. Right. Many of you know about this, right? And rightfully so, right? And so part of it is going to be this attempt to sort of do a kind of community-based policing and involvement and actually drawing upon, in a lot of communities, they're actually self-defense militias that had been created, and the government went in and said, you can't do this, you know, you've got to put down your arms and let the army do its work, and yet the army was kind of more in collusion with the bad guys than these self-defense militias were. So I think there's some idea of actually trying to collaborate with those groups, trying to use government resources to counteract some of the extortion that goes on, to actually provide incentives there's an attempt to provide incentives for people involved in the narcotics industry to leave and to actually literally leave and go far away from that region, kind of almost like a relocation program. Because one of the big problems is that once people get involved in this, they're trapped, right? They can't get out. A lot of people are kind of forcibly recruited into the drug industry, and becomes
no different than America.
Yeah. And into the extortion industry. They're the ones who go out and threaten the store owners and so forth, because they're being told if you don't do that, you're going to get killed, right? And so this series of threats that even within those organizations exist. And so I think part of what I've read in his policy is to create a kind of amnesty program for some of the lower level people involved in that industry, to try to get them out of there, to kind of reduce the size and intensity of that pressure. But it's a good question. I don't really know exactly a lot of the details of how he's going to approach it differently. Yeah. One last question? Yes, sir.
Can I completely change your point of view here?
Not sure.
How important is the brain drain?
Huh.
Because you're an educator, and I was a faculty member at a major university, and I know that some of the Mexican food centers, they can't afford to go home.
Yeah.
I mean, you become a faculty member of a major university and you need another job to pay the rent.
Right. For those of you who don't know, the term brain drain, it's something we use in education, talk about how a lot of society, especially developing societies, often their most talented and smartest young people either go off and study abroad and end up staying abroad. Therefore, the brains, the resources, the talent and intelligence is being drained from that country because they end up going and working elsewhere. Or sometimes those that graduate from their own national universities end up getting jobs, right? In Mexico, you know, compared to some other places, the brain drain problem is not nearly as great. It's certainly a problem and an issue, but the national university system and the state university system is quite robust in terms of absorbing, and that's partly because of large government expenditure, federal and state government expenditure. So university academic positions are fairly viable and attractive, you know, compared to a lot of countries like Mexico, where the salaries of people with PhDs and master's degrees are miserable. In industry, it's a more mixed story. You know, people working as engineers in the sciences and so forth, and pharmaceuticals, they are vulnerable to being hired, obviously, and enjoying a high. And I think that part of the brain drain in Mexico is not merely economic, but is also driven by the conditions of insecurity. So if AMLO can get under control the corruption and the violence, then that's going to minimize the brain drain, because the brain drain isn't simply people choosing to get better salaries. You know, and this is one of the myths, of course, and I'm probably preaching to the choir here, but this idea that almost all Mexicans, given half the chance, would love to come and live in the United States, because who wouldn't, right? The standard of living here, even living in poverty here, is much better than living in poverty in Mexico. But the truth is, you know, Mexicans are very proud, and of course they'd rather be in a dominant Spanish-speaking country where they're comfortable, and if they can get the problem of violence and insecurity, that economically the conditions are not that adverse to reverse what brain drain does exist, to have people to come back and live. A lot of it is a brain drain now is because people are afraid to raise their kids in Mexico, especially certain regions in Mexico, and there's no trust in the judicial system or in the police system, in the military system. So that hopefully will stem some of the brain drain as well. So thank you very much for your attention. It was a pleasure to meet you. And I'll see you around. Be in the village until Saturday. Happy to chat with some of you further.